Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Good morning. This is DW's Africa Link program. I'm Jane Ayeka Kumet in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, South Sudan's rebel leader Riek Machar calls for armed resistance against the government in Juba. We'll be hearing from this analyst.
I don't see Riek Machar coming back full force with his troops, but what I see is definitely a fragmentation into much smaller fighting units, potentially even longer and more devastating.
And we hear what South Africans are making of student protests for free university education for all.
I can hear where the students are coming from, but I don't think a free education will do good for us because it will decrease our quality of our education.
It's okay, but the violence is out of order.
And there will be more reports coming from Zimbabwe and Nigeria. Stay tuned.
Top story.
From friends to political rivals, from armed fighting to a war of bitter exchange, that seems to be the current state of affairs in South Sudan. Rebel leader Riek Machar, who is now in exile in Khartoum, has accused President Salva Kiir of wanting to turn the country into an ethnic state for his Dinka ethnic group. He has called on the international community to declare President Salva Kiir's government a rogue regime. President Salva Kiir responded by saying he is prepared for war. James Manula with the details.
Drums of war are echoing across South Sudan, Africa's newest nation, and a country that is still recovering from years of fighting between President Salva Kiir and his principal political and military opponent, Riek Machar. The fighting claimed lives of more than 300 people. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, estimated that 1 million Sudanese have fled the country and sought refuge in neighboring countries. The UN Security Council has authorized 4,000 troops to be deployed to South Sudan to protect civilians, but they are yet to arrive. When they do it, it would bring the number of UN peacekeeping troops in the country to 17,000. As the people of South Sudan eagerly wait for the arrival of the UN Protection Force, former Vice President Riek Machar has broken his 5-week silence by declaring war against the government of President Salva Kiir in Juba. Speaking to DW by telephone from Sudan's capital Khartoum, Riek Machar's spokesman James Gadet Dak characterized Machar's declaration as a stand against Salva Kiir's troops.
This is resistance. Salva Kiir has declared war on us, so we are preparing for resistance. The time will come when we will decide to enter Juba, but certainly we are on the defensive.
Responding swiftly to Riek Machar's declaration of war against his government, President Salva Kiir sounded ready for battle.
Should he come with whatever military force that he had, he will also be met with such a force. There will be peace. That is a peace where I don't think side characters like Dr. Machar and others should not be part of. Nobody will overrun you.
Kiir says that he is not prepared to relinquish power. Doing so, he says, would pave the way for genocide reminiscent of the massive killings that occurred in Rwanda more than 20 years ago.
If I leave this here today, you will be talking about genocide in South Sudan.
The genocide that President Kiir is referring to is likely to pit his Dinka tribe against the Nuer, to which Riek Machar belongs. As the rhetoric and violence ramps up, many experts believe that the probability of continued violence and war is becoming more possible. This is something most ordinary Sudanese do not want to happen. All I have to say to our leaders, to my fellow citizens, is that what I wish is to see power of love of South Sudanese overcoming the love for power, said one man.
James Shimanyula reporting. Now, is there any hope left for peace in South Sudan? Mark Caldwell put that question to Annette Weber, an analyst well-versed with the affairs of the troubled country and a senior fellow with the German Institute for International and Security Affairs in Berlin.
It's really hard to scramble the pieces of hope together. It's quite difficult to see the situation fully right now. I think there is hope left when we think about a full-fledged war between SPLA in opposition and SPLA. I don't see this war particularly to resume. I don't see Riek Machar coming back full force with his troops, but what I see is definitely a fragmentation into much smaller fighting units, not necessarily under the command of either Riek Machar or the President Salva Kiir, and so potentially even longer and more devastating non-peace situation or war situation than what we have seen in the last couple of years.
Salva Kiir has said in response to Machar's remarks that should he come with whatever force that he has, he will also be met with such a force. Can we assume that both sides are really serious?
I think both sides are really serious, but also both sides show that really the responsibility for peace effort and for the well-being of their own population is not at their heart. And I think this is what makes the message of these two leaders so depressing, that they're not focusing on how to get back on the feet for their country and how to develop the population or how to bring development for the population, but rather to go back to the old rhetoric of going back to war, another slaughter, another phase of war, as if the country would not need something else.
What are other countries in the region, countries that belong to the regional bloc IGAD, making of this latest development?
I think there is a lot of frustration in the neighboring countries, such as Ethiopia, for example, but also if you look at the refugee numbers in Ethiopia, but also, of course, in Uganda and Kenya. These countries put a lot of effort in the last round of peace negotiations that came to closure last August, and they really wanted the country to go back and, you know, start being a country. So there's not much appetite for war, but there's also a nervousness of this war spilling over and becoming a more regional war. And I think this is, of course, what the neighboring countries are most concerned with.
These remarks by Machar came just a couple of days after his successor as vice president, Taban Dengai, told the media on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly that South Sudan didn't need peacekeepers. How do you interpret these remarks?
Of course, the question is, what can the additional peacekeepers do? And what they're up to do is specifically keep peace in Juba, which with an additional force, of course, is quite helpful. What they cannot do and what they're not mandated and what they shouldn't do is bringing the expectations that the peacekeepers from outside could bring the peace in South Sudan. And this is really where the responsibility for the South Sudanese political elite lies. And this elite is including Riek Machar as well as Taban Dengai.
Annette Weber, Senior Fellow with the German Institute for International and Security Affairs in Berlin.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
You're still listening to Africa Link. Off now to Nigeria, where the purported leader of the Islamic militant group Boko Haram, Abubakar Shekou, has appeared in a video posted on social media in which he rejected statements by the Nigerian military that he had been seriously wounded. In the recent years, the Nigerian military has said on numerous occasions that it had killed or injured Shekou, but their remarks have been followed by strenuous denials from somebody claiming to be Boko Haram leader. DW's Ben Shimang in Abuja has been speaking to Mark Caldwell about the Nigerian government's position on the video.
Honestly, Mark, there are doubts as to the personality of the person who now parades himself as Abubakar Shekou. Some analysts will say that the voice does not tally with the old first Shekou. Apart from that, the old Shekou is darker in color, in complexion. So there are doubts that this could be the Shekou. More so, the one that was killed long ago, some of the Boko Haram members testified that that was the original Shekou.
The Nigerian military says that Boko Haram is as good as defeated, but their spokesman admitted on Monday that Islamic extremists, in other words, suspected members of Boko Haram, had just killed 8 Nigerian soldiers in 2 recent attacks. Do ordinary Nigerians believe that Boko Haram has been defeated?
Well, absolutely, many Nigerians believe that Boko Haram has been defeated, bearing in mind that those days their attacks were always massive, the destructions massive, and you could see them doing it with a kind of disdain, feeling that they are on top of the situation. But today, the military and some Nigerians will also believe that the attacks are just what they call pockets of attacks, isolated cases, because absolutely there is no territory, no local government that these people now occupy any longer.
In this latest video, Shekau, or the man who purports to be Shekau, said the parents of the kidnapped Chibok schoolgirls would only see their offspring again if the government swaps them for detained Boko Haram leaders. Is such a swap going to take place?
Well, the president, Muhammadu Buhari, has always said that he is ready for that swap. But at the point, he said, look, if the Boko Haram members can appoint a neutral body, whether it's the Red Cross Society or whoever. And when he went to New York, he even invited the United Nations, where he said the UN can simply come into this crisis and mediate between the federal government and Boko Haram so that the girls are released. And if there are commanders on ground that could be released, they should be released.
Ben Shimang in Abuja.
Africa on the move.
Many African cities are groaning under mountains of waste. One way to get rid of it is incinerate it. But if the fire isn't hot enough, toxic substances which are harmful to human health are released into the atmosphere. However, if the waste is burned at the right temperature, you get clean supply of heat which can be used for communal cooking. This report from Nairobi's Kibera Slum was sent to us by Linda Staude and is now read for Africa on the Move by Natalie Muller.
Jessica Undye puts a flat piece of dough on the cooktop. She lets it sizzle for a minute and then flips it over. Carefully rolled, thin rounds of dough are piled up next to her, ready to be cooked.
I am making chapatis for lunch, chapatis and tea.
The young woman is a bit behind time with her preparations. Usually the neat brick stove in Nairobi's Kibera slum is in use from 6 o'clock onwards, but today the cook couldn't come, so Jessica Undye has to improvise. There's more than just chapatis on the stove now.
Dengu, beans.
Today it's lentils, meat and beans, but it changes all the time.
Meat, hey, gotta change.
Soon a delicious smell fills the air, in spite of the pile of garbage towering behind a low wall. It serves as fuel for the community cooker, project manager Constantine Jongesa explains.
Rubbish is all over. We don't have a dumping site, so our main dumping site is in the dam, which is so close to our site. And we have a stream that collects all rubbish all the way from the other side of Makina. It is very easy for us to have that rubbish.
The mix of household waste, plastic bottles and paper is free fuel for the kitchen fire. But it's potentially dangerous, as it could harm the entire area with cancerous dioxin and furan. Jim Archer is the architect who initiated the project.
You have to burn at over 800 degrees centigrade. Now, of course, then I hadn't the remotest idea how difficult it would be to produce clean heat. And I suppose, quite honestly, if I had known, I'd perhaps have run away from the whole thing.
Archer said he was annoyed about the endless piles of rubbish around the place. James Kamaru, a young man from Kibera, is stuffing waste into the cooker. There are buckets dangling from both sides of the metal hatch.
This one for oil and this one for nini, for the water. We just mix water and oil to accelerate the fire inside. The fire, when we start burning. After the jiko is burned, we just put off.
The simple construction creates temperatures of more than 1,000 degrees without releasing toxic substances. And it's giving new value to the garbage, says Anne Kanini from Kibera.
Instead of throwing in the river, they just bring somewhere. There is a dumping site somewhere, of which we know that it is useful to us. And also it is making the community also clean.
And it also brings in money. The community sells the food in a small open-air restaurant and cooks lunch for the school next door. Four community cookers are ready to use, three more are currently being constructed, and potential customers are already waiting. Jim Archer and his team have moved on to experiment with a new idea, turning waste into electricity.
Just think what we could do with simple electricity that doesn't fail every two or three days like it does here. We can work wonders.
That report was written by Linda Stoude. Now off to South Africa, where student protests calling for free higher education were resumed at universities on Monday. The demonstrations, some accompanied by violence, began last week after the government announced fee increase of up to 8% for next year, from which, however, poor students would be exempt. Controversy over university tuition fees has highlighted widespread frustration about the lack of opportunities for young people in South Africa, made worse by the economic downturn. Sobri Govenda reports.
Student protests for free higher education in South Africa turned violent once again at several universities around the country on Monday. Students at the Pietermaritzburg campus of the University of KwaZulu-Natal burnt down a student residence and a number of cars. These incidents follow the recent burning down of a library and a number of cars at the Durban campus of the same university. Similar incidents took place at the University of Johannesburg, Tshwane University of Technology in Pretoria, University of Pretoria, and the University of Mpumalanga and the University of Limpopo, north of Pretoria. These universities have now suspended academic activities. The University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg and the University of Cape Town have also shut down indefinitely following violent protests. Ordinary rank-and-file students, while supporting the call for free tertiary education, have expressed their rejection of all forms of violence.
And the violence is not right. I can hear where the students coming from, but I don't think free education will do good for us because it will decrease our quality of our education.
It's okay, but the violence is out of order because it's an act of criminality. One has to understand that the free education is not a quick thing to achieve, hence it takes time.
All the affected universities have stepped up their security with increased police presence and the introduction of private security guards. The spokesperson for the University of KwaZulu-Natal, Leslie Seshoka, said security at their five campuses had been heightened.
There is no way that we would want to halt teaching and learning because the students have already lost about 3 weeks. So if they had to lose any more time, it would actually mean that we would have to postpone the academic program until next year.
One of the worst affected by the student protests is the University of the Witwatersrand. Vice Chancellor Professor Adam Abib called for student leaders to stop the violence.
I would be prepared today to move private security off the campus if first of the three things: commit to non-violence, commit to letting the academic program happen, commit to no arson, and if anybody does that, they agree that I can suspend and expel.
Veteran freedom icon Winnie Madikizela Mandela, who celebrated her 80th birthday on Monday, also called on government and students to resolve the problem.
It's a very serious problem, and I think the only solution to this problem will be if the state somehow must find a way of meeting the students halfway.
The violent student protests are also of serious concern to leaders outside the political and academic world. The Zulu king, Goodwill Zwelithini, who celebrated 45 years on the throne last weekend, has called on parents to take immediate action to bring their children at universities to order.
Sobri Govenda reporting.
Making a difference.
Attempts to combat the HIV/AIDS pandemic are often hampered by unwillingness of the authorities to work together with sexual minorities. That's a complaint that is often made by activists fighting to eradicate the disease. Stigmatizing LGBTI groups does nothing to help stamp out HIV, the activists say. In Zimbabwe, such stigmatization and discrimination is rife, but one campaigner remains undaunted. Our correspondent in Harare, Privilege Mushanri, has been talking to her for this week's Making a Difference.
Her passion to work with minority communities with high prevalence of HIV and AIDS is what Mother Tolana is known for. Now at the age of 51, Tolana tested positive in 2003, but has since been living healthy for 13 years. It was like a death sentence, she tells me, but she chose to fight the stigma and discrimination behind the disease. In Zimbabwe, minority communities such as sex workers and the LGBTI community are often marginalized in sexual and reproductive health programs. But Tolana says the fight against HIV and AIDS cannot be won if minorities are left out.
We talk of leaving no one behind. If we are to get to zero, like we have all these slogans, we won't reach those slogans if some sectors of the population are left behind because of their identity.
While Zimbabwe has made great strides in the reduction of new infections, the government has not been able to include minority groups such as bisexual and transgender communities. Currently, due to stigma and discrimination, there is no statistics on the number of LGBTI people living with HIV. Chester Samba, director of Gays and Lesbians Association of Zimbabwe, GALS, says the push by rights activists like Martha Tolana could be the only way to ensure inclusion.
Martha has done some commendable work around LGBTI issues, particularly in the health sector, and also looking at her level of participation around HIV work in government. Because she's very active in national platforms, she's been able to carry forward the issue of LGBTI people in those spaces.
Tolana has faced social and political scrutiny for representing minority communities. In 2012, she was arrested and charged with running an unregistered organization. Samba says they often worry about Martha's courage to represent their interest.
Being an ally herself, for most of the time we worry about her security. We worry about her welfare as well, because it's not a simple issue to take forward being non-LGBT like herself.
Martha Tolana has received international recognition for her work. She is a recipient of the prestigious Elizabeth Taylor 2016 award at the Durban South Africa World AIDS Conference.
The winner of this year's Elizabeth Taylor Human Rights Award is Martha Tolana from Zimbabwe.
According to Tolana, Zimbabwe's justice system silently promotes stigma by failing to use scientific evidence in convicting people jailed for willful transmission of HIV.
The justice system does not use scientific knowledge, and people are still getting convicted for HIV transmission.
At 15%, Zimbabwe has the fifth highest HIV prevalence in sub-Saharan Africa. About 1.4 million people are living with the disease, including 170,000 children, which is 4% of the global figure.
Privilege Mushanri in Harare. And before I leave you, here is a reminder of some of the stories that we've been covering for you today. South Sudan's rebel leader Riek Machar has called for armed resistance against the South Sudanese government. Nigeria's military says 8 soldiers were killed in 2 attacks by Islamic extremists in the country's northeast. We've also been hearing how the fight against HIV/AIDS in Zimbabwe is being hampered by the unwillingness of the authorities to engage with sexual minorities. And with that, we come to the end of this edition of Africa Link. Don't forget, we welcome your comments on this program. You can send us an email to feedback.africa@dw.com or an SMS to country code 49160957595510 or a letter to Africa Link DW53110 Bonn, Germany. And for more news, visit our website dw.com/africa. From me, Jane Ayeka Kumet, look at life from the positive side. Goodbye. We'll be right back.